Ryan Stanton here with ASEP Frontline. Today, joined by Dr. Howard Mell, or as we call him, Howie, emergency physician, locums physician, traveling the world in the seven seas, who is here today to talk with us about strokes. One of the most painful topics that we can talk about, the figurative hemorrhoid of education, with its constant changing and pushes to treat faster, earlier, and more often. I think it gives us all a little bit of an angina whenever those patients come in, and I feel like eventually we're going to be trying to TPA patients in their beds before they call 911. Maybe we'll just send it home and have people administer it themselves before they call 911. But there's a couple of articles that have come out. One recently, March 8th, 2017, in the journal Neurology, Reduction in Time to Treatment in Pre-Hospital Telemedicine Evaluation in Thrombolysis. And it's out of Cleveland Pre-Hospital Acute Stroke Treatment Group, the FAST group. But that's a PH, FAST group. So, Dr. Mell, thanks for joining me.
Thank you. So, we have a very interesting thing that's been happening in pre-hospital medicine. There is this idea of a stroke ambulance. There's been an ambulance created that has a CT scanner on board, and we put a paramedic, usually coupled with a nurse or a physician, or the FAST group at Cleveland use their telemedicine approach to this. But in any event, the idea is that somebody has a stroke, calls an ambulance, and a team rushes out, and they do thrombolysis in the field. With a CT being performed in the field on their way to the hospital.
All right. So give me an idea. I mean, the whole idea behind this is we're trying to cut that door to perfusion time, or that door to treatment time. And so now we're pushing it out into the front line. And where did this idea come from? Because this group wasn't the first to have this idea. Where did this really come out of?
So the idea seems to have originated in Europe, and I think one of the driving impetuses for it, was the fact that the technology existed to put the CT scanner on the ambulance. And I think that that's kind of one of the problems, right, is that this is a solution in search of a problem. Because we've had a lot of different groups that have looked at this. The Cleveland group came out very recently with their article, but prior to that, there was a thing called the Phantom S study that looked at it in Berlin. They did an almost three-year trial, and the problem is that these folks keep on reporting data that probably doesn't matter to you and I. It's a funny story, but my daughter, when she was first born, my eldest daughter, my wife was very into neurobiology, and she wanted us to not use any baby talk and use big words. It's supposed to develop her brain. And so I got in the habit, she was born during residency, that I would read journal articles to her to put her to sleep, and it put me to sleep too. Mm-hmm. And very, very rarely got past
it. I can see that.
But now that she's, a couple of years ago, she was 9 years old, and she was still in that phase where every once in a while she would, crawl into my lap and ask me to what I was reading. And I read her one of the original studies, which was basically the pilot for this. She said, "Well, Daddy, what does it mean?" When I read the whole thing, I said, "There's a medicine that some people think helps if somebody has a stroke. So they found a way to put it onto an ambulance with a CT scanner and to give the medicine. And this study says that they give it faster." And she said, "Well, what does it really say?" I said, that's what it says, honey. She says, "No, Daddy, that's not a study. You don't need a study to tell you that if they give a medicine faster, they give a medicine faster." And I said, it's kind of from the mouths of babes here, right? I mean, this is the data that we keep on seeing out of this group is, hey, this stuff, we give the medicine faster. Okay. What are the outcomes? Mm-hmm. Well, when you actually look at the outcomes from the Phantom S study, it says that there was a trend towards improved outcome, no difference in mortality, and they didn't reach statistical significance on any objective measure of care. So The question becomes, well, why are we doing all this? And the question also becomes, what's the cost for benefit? And so if you take the Berlin data and you actually take it down to the number of people they treated versus the population that they were protecting, what you quickly get to is a calculation that suggests that you need about 220,000 patients or 220,000 population protected in order to reduce disability in one person. And that's a great cost. So the question really becomes, is this worth it? Before we even ask, does TPA work, which is a whole different discussion that I'm sure we could have for, you know, hours, we have to look at just their data, and we take the best estimate, and you really quickly realize that there's just not that many people that call within the window who are eligible for TPA and get TPA. And that's leaving aside the fact that the Cleveland study only administered TPA 16 times. The Berlin study had a little bit more robust time. If we were to extrapolate out the Cleveland data, there would be a whole lot larger population needed to be served before we're saving somebody. Now, to their benefit, I will point out that the Cleveland authors have a slightly less expensive mobile stroke unit because they don't put a doctor on board, they use telemedicine. But at the end of the day, it's really hard to justify in my mind. You know, if we leave aside the issue of TPA and we just get to what's going on, I don't know that, I mean, I don't know. What would you think about having an ambulance completely dedicated to helping home births?
To me, it seems like a solution looking for a problem that it theoretically helps. You know, I'm one of those that feels like we've been hemmed and hawed for a decade now on TPA anyway. And now we're finally in the pendulum swing. We swung into giving it, then we swung back to, could be dangerous. Now we're swinging back to, we need to give it. We need to give it more often. We need to give it earlier. And you're absolutely right. To me, the question we need to answer is the dollars needed to treat. I mean, there's always a number needed to treat. You know, the number needed to benefit, number needed to harm. What is in this case, the dollars needed to benefit? So how much money are we going to spend before we get a significant viable benefit from this approach? Because I completely agree. We're taking one diagnosis and setting up an entire system around it, a system that is going to be very costly. Just an ambulance with a CT scanner, not counting staffing, is going to be hideously expensive and potentially cost prohibitive for most places. But I think a lot of it has to do with banking on the reimbursements you get for hitting TPA on somebody.
Well, I agree with that. I mean, I think some of it is driven by industry. There were certainly some questions in some of the early studies about industry relations. The authors in the latest study from the Cleveland Clinic don't report any. But I think it kind of goes a little bit broader than that when we talk about EMS and we talk about costs. Because EMS is public health at its base. Mm-hmm. And we know how to do EMS incredibly well with incredible outcomes, right? If you look at the President of the United States, who travels with an entourage of an ambulance, a nurse practitioner, a couple of paramedics, some typed and crossed blood and all this, and all presidents have for many years. This isn't the current administration thing, but they travel with this. We know that if they need EMS, their outcomes are going to be incredible. Mm-hmm. However, the costs are extreme, right? We couldn't do that for every person in the U.S. So somewhere between that and no EMS at all, we have to make some judgments about how much are we going to spend to do the most good for the most people. And I think my biggest consternation with this is the idea that if we push these out sooner and we spend all this money, even if we take all of the TPA data at face value, and even if we take all of these studies at face value, what you really end up with is, a small city of 220,000 persons is going to reduce disability, but for one person per year. And it's great if you're that person. Mm-hmm. But if you're the other 219,999 people that live in that community, was there a better way to spend the money that we're spending on these mobile stroke units that could have benefited more people?
Did any of the studies quote the cost associated with, you know, how much it cost per day or per month in order to translate potentially into how much it's costing for this study to get 16 TPA treatments during a year period.
So what's interesting is, number one, it doesn't actually change mortality. So that's number one. So the only study that was done on this was part of the Phantom S study. It was published in Neurology March 17th of 2015. It was a cost effectiveness. And what they decided through this was that there would be an annual expected health gain of avoidance of 18 cases of disability. And they credited that being 29.7 quality of life years. So they said, well, it's going to cost just about 32,456 euro, because this was a study in Germany, per quality. The problem with that is it's not actually using the outcomes data from this, right? What they're saying is that they believe that this earlier administration of TPA will give you this 18 cases of disability. And the problem is that the later work didn't actually show that. In fact, they couldn't statistically show that there was a difference in disability, although to be fair to those who are for these units, there was a trend toward it, but they did not reach statistical significance. The only thing they have significantly proven is that they can give the drug earlier.
Mm-hmm.
It's an awful lot of money to give a drug earlier. And when we start talking about the numbers and the study for cost effectiveness, again, the issue is you're making a whole lot of assumptions about how effective this thing is.
And I find it to be outside the control. I mean, it's difficult to justify a single purpose mobile unit with CT scanner for. I mean, the question is, with these mobile stroke units that are going to be responding, how much of that, so our EMS in Lexington, the average call to scene time is less than 8 minutes. And so then the call to ER time is probably total 20 to 25 minutes. How much of that time do you gain that back or lose it by, you know, having this unit that has to be deployed out from a central location, I assume, one of the hospitals, and has to be deployed out where a local or another EMS unit is significantly closer. And so if we're saying that all the known benefit so far is that TPA is administered faster, at what cost, not only with the financial cost, but also other times, responses, and other risks associated with having a unit like this?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that that's one thing. And I think the other, though, is to take it, you know, not to try and do a slippery slope argument, but at what point do we stop doing this? Like I said, do we get a midwife and an advanced ultrasound on the ambulance in order to respond to home births gone bad? Do we get an intensivist to sit on the ambulance, again, with an ultrasound and maybe some central line gear? Are we going to start the sepsis bundle at the bedside? There's a number of things. But at the end of the day, you know, the question is, just because we do it in the hospital, should we be doing it in the field? And if so, what is the actual incremental change in patient outcomes? And that's the part that's really not been reported on well here. The only study that we have is the Phantom S out of Berlin, which didn't show that benefit. And so why are we continuing with this expenditure of money when we could be spending it on stroke prevention, when we could be spending it on CPR education, when we could be spending it on a number of other public health things that are core to the mission of EMS and would certainly be helpful?
I personally believe that if you're going to do something with this amount of investment, there needs to be a significant return on investment in terms of benefit to patients, survival, and more importantly, recovery. And not just a trend, but I mean a significant. So I am fully supportive of the units that are specifically designed for pediatric neonatal transport because they're specialty care. They're used frequently, and it's a special population that needs special attention and has unique risks. So we have one locally for us. There's actually two. And I think there's significant benefit in that. Whereas this one, where we're talking about even with the potential of shading data, that we've only gotten to the point of a trend, and the only positive we can report is that it's faster. I don't see how in a cash-strapped system like the United States healthcare system is, how you justify a system. How do you justify a stroke-related ambulance? I mean, unless you've just got a population of, you know, that's a stroke epidemic in your region, you're responding four times a day.
Well, and even if you are responding four times a day, remember, you got to be within the window.
Yeah.
Right? And so what we know from the Cleveland experience, they went out an awful lot of times, but they only administered TPA 16 times. Berlin also, you know, there were many, many more calls than were administered TPA, and that's the other problem. So, you know, somebody calls 6 hours after their stroke onset, or they call with the waking stroke, or they call with the stroke that happened yesterday. This unit is still sent out, but TPA isn't given. So we've got this grand cost for little gain, and it just doesn't pass the sniff test for me at all. So I'm fine with the existing units, with existing studies gathering data. Data are a good thing. We want them, but I'm with you. Unless one of these studies pops really positive in a way that really demonstrates that this is just changing lots of lives per the dollar spent on it, I'm not sold.
And I, you know, when I'm dealing with our EMS services in Lexington, if I have to make a choice between having basically two or three more buggies on the street versus one, the investment necessary for one stroke unit, I will any day of the week take two or three more buggies on the street to respond to every case as opposed to having one in reserve for a specific case that's not going to pay off significant benefits to my patient population.
Yeah, but I will, you know, without, I don't want to denigrate fully the work from the Cleveland Clinic. The one thing that they did prove seemingly very well is that the earlier studies were all done with doctors on the ambulance, which increased the cost significantly. Mm-hmm. I do think that the FAST group out of the Cleveland Clinic has at least proven the idea that this could be done via telemedicine. I'm just still not sold. Yes, you've reduced the cost, but you haven't proven that the care works. So
I think there is benefit in the telemedicine, telehealth access to frontline medicine, to EMS transports, the EMS response. I think there's a huge potential there. But not just in stroke. I mean, more across the board access. I've seen it with, again, referring back to pediatric intensive care related consultations and management, being able to have that access. And I think there is potential there of having a cost-effective method for which to have higher-level expertise accessed en route and on scene. But I don't believe that stroke is going to be the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow for this technology.
I agree with you. I agree with you fully. And I appreciate you having me on to discuss this. I do want to take a moment, make a little bit of an announcement. Based on your success and ASEP's sponsoring of your podcast, we have the Education Committee from ASEP has asked me to start another podcast. And this one, as you can imagine, given my personality, is going to be a little bit more of a skeptics podcast. It's going to be called So What? And we're going to be examining whether any of the trends that pop on social media really have value in the day-to-day clinical practice out in the community. So that's something to look forward to. And I certainly appreciate you having me on today so that we could talk about these mobile stroke units and also to announce this new endeavor for ASEP.
So what? Tell me, for So What, give us an example of what you're talking about, this skeptics idea of So Me popping foam at There's a lot of stuff I just
You could get a couple more acronyms that nobody.
I don't know.
So I think that there's a lot of residents who are coming forward, and they're on social media, they're on Facebook, they're really hyper aware of the literature as it is out there, and sometimes as it is interpreted by people within Twitter and social media, and they'll come to their attending with the idea of, hey, you know, this patient's been in refractory VFib. Should we try double sequential defibrillation? Or, you know, certainly no DSAT's been kind of a game changer for a lot of us in our practice. You know, there's starting to be rumblings that we can actually give the proparacaine drops to people with corneal abrasions and we don't cause the ulcerations. And there's all these kind of, for lack of a better phrase, crazy ideas that are out there. And I think what we're trying to do with So What is to actually get some of the folks who work with residents on a daily basis in and to talk to us about these new emerging trends and whether they're ready for prime time or not ready for prime time. You know, ketamine for pain is another good one that we'll certainly be taking a look at. What the idea is that we want to distill down the stuff that's available out there and see if it really is useful for the day-to-day practice of emergency medicine.
So getting the ideas and seeing if the research and information behind it really backs it up, and if it's got legs for our use in emergency medicine.
Yeah, because I think a lot of things get legs on social media far past their actual utility.
Well, that's the challenge with social media, especially if it's in 140 characters or less when it comes to the Twitterage, is that you lose the context in the rest of the story. So just like talking about the stroke ambulance, the report is a positive conclusion because it decreased time, but the rest of the picture is not there, the cost, the benefit to the patients, anything like that. So filling in the rest of that picture for this great idea. So ketamine for pain, yes, it's a great option. In who? When? What cases? Who's it not work for? Who do we need to watch out for? Those are the things that we need to fill in the blanks. And, you know, for me, not even just having more of the academic side, I think a lot of us in community medicine are seeing these trends and things popping up. And I'll come to my partners and I'll say, hey, have you heard about, you know, lidocaine, the IV lidocaine for kidney stones, for renal colic? And, you know, then we start that debate and having to bring out the research and figuring where it really sits and what it shows and when we use it and when we don't use it. So I see this being a way to take that cutting-edge medical research and then seeing what there is to back it up. And if there's not stuff to back it up, what evidence is there anecdotally to say this could be a treatment of option or something we need to let go by the wayside?
So the thing that started this for me was there was a really fun report in Anesthesiology, which is unusual access to airway with transorbital intubation. And literally what they did on an elective case is this was going to be a heavy, extensive facial surgery with a guy that was going to be an airway challenge, Mallampati 4, all this. And they decided, because the gentleman had lost his right orbit, to remove his prosthetic eye and actually intubate through the orbit down through the nose and into the trachea. Now this was a planned thing. It's a very interesting article. It was published in September 2014 in Anesthesiology, and there's some great graphic pictures about this. But this was obviously a planned case with lots of care and thought going into it. And as soon as somebody put it out on Twitter, and it kind of got some legs because some popular people tweeted it, and it certainly is something that's really interesting to talk about, I got several DMs from paramedics going, well, if we can't get the airway and the guy's got a fake eye, can we just pop that out in tube? And you come to realize that it's not their fault. It's the fact that when so many people are talking about something like this, people lose the facts surrounding
the context.
The context. They lose the question. There's several things that are very popular topics on social media that when you go back to the original literature, it's a three-person case series, and that's what we really want to distill down for the folks who aren't, you know, super active on phone or super active in social media, what are the things that people are talking about, and is there really a good idea there or not? And hence the title. So what? Great. Somebody said that this works. Does it? And so we look forward to bringing that to you as a monthly podcast.
Has anybody asked that guy, though, what he thinks about the fact that anytime he sneezes now, his eyeball becomes a projectile? Assault with a deadly weapon?
I don't think so. I certainly haven't seen that follow-up, but it is a graphic picture.
It's a nasty picture.
It's a nasty picture. This was done in Brazil, I believe. So I don't know that this person's available. If we can find him, it'd be a great interview.
It would be a great interview. I mean, until he sneezed and killed one of us. All right, fantastic. So what, check that at that podcast out. It'll be another great one, and knowing Howie, we're going to have some fantastic information. He is well-versed in the Foam Ed community as well as the Twitterage and the podcasting. So it'll roll in, and I'm sure it's going to have some really cool information and one that we'll add to our little automatic downloads, and so you can feel comforted that I will be listening to your podcast on a treadmill before my shift on some late evening in Lexington, Kentucky. So at least you're going to have an N of one at that point, which is larger than some of the studies I'm sure you'll talk about.
Absolutely.
All right, how can folks get in touch with you, and where can we find Howie Mel?
So I'm on Twitter at Dr. Howie Mel. It's at DrHowieMell. You can get a hold of me on email. It's howie.mell@gmail.com.
And as for me, like our ASAP Frontline page on Facebook, as well as at Everyday Med on Twitter. And you're always welcome to email me, youreverydaymedicine@gmail.com, youreverydaymedicine@gmail.com. And until next time, I'm Dr. Ryan Stanton, and this has been some ASAP Frontline.